Welcome, everyone. Hello, world. Wow. I knew that was going to happen. It's the reason I was taking a second. I'm like, is my throat clear?
No, try that again. And action.
Hello, world. Welcome to WFHR's Director's Cut, Session 56. And a special one here today, Seth.
It is. It's an anniversary show. It has been 2 years since we recorded the very first episode of Director's Cut 56. It's
pretty cool.
2 years.
Yeah.
I have trouble wrapping my brain around that.
And I swear I didn't forget it was our anniversary, Seth. Just give me a second to go to my car. I just got to get something out of my... I got your gift in the car.
Yeah,
I got
all right.
We should really be getting all of you a gift. Thank you so much for making this show as popular as it is and well-known as it is and all the great guests we have had over the last couple of years.
So many good guests. Oh,
This award-winning show.
It is award-winning.
That we are very proud of. And humbled by because you guys make it the show. We appreciate you doing that. Mm-hmm. And just as a reminder, we are still looking to have every single creative in this area on the air with us.
Every single. It's our mission.
Feel free to reach out to us. Spread the word about the show so we can make sure that more creatives are able to get on the air with us. We can get every musician, every talented human being we got in this area on this show, Director's Cut, which is what we do. We focus on the creatives in Central Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we're having a little bit of fun. We're going to, the second half of the show, we're going to do a replay. We're going to kind of rewind a little bit
from our very first episode. We talked a little bit about what is a scary or suspenseful movie to do this holiday season and during the Halloween season. So we're going to redo that one because I thought it was pretty good. I think it was a lot of fun to do too.
And I agree. And speaking of the holiday season, we thought we'd get a little macabre with you. Take care of an interesting story that I've had for a little while here that I've been wanting to do. Seth, they always say you cannot take it with you.
That's true.
But we have here some celebrities that may argue with that a little bit. I've got here a list of items that celebrities took to the grave. There are some ones here that actually have made the rounds a little bit, have shown up on our show over the years that we've touched on just kind of organically.
That's true.
And we kind of start right there with Bela Lugosi and Dracula's cape.
That's right. And this is one we have talked about, I think, a little bit. But it was... I remember seeing an interview with his son, Bela Lugosi Jr., who never went into business. He's an attorney, by the way, which I thought was pretty interesting. Yeah, he never went into the business or anything like that. But he said when he died, when Bela Sr. died, that he and his mother, who was his wife at the time, he was married several times, but decided that they were going to bury him in his cape. He said, my dad never said specifically he wanted to, but they thought it was very fitting. And it went very iconic, you know, of course. Dracula's cape, I mean, from if you've seen the 1931 movie, you know, I mean, it not only is it Bela's look and his voice and everything, you know, this is who Dracula is in our mind, right? It's the costume. It's the big jewel, you know, on his chest and the tuxedo and that cape. And that's to me, there's so much iconography in that. And it's very suitable that he ended up in his cape.
The story and book had obviously been around for a very long time, but it wasn't until then that anybody had any idea what Dracula looked like.
He set the standard for
what Dracula would forever look like. I don't know if you can have Dracula. Certainly, you can't have Dracula without the teeth. You might need the cape just as much.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost just as important. It's really cool. And I think you know, meaningful to. It's so, you know, our loved ones give us these things and that they would like when they pass.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really on us to continue that and do something up with that.
Right.
And it's pretty admirable to hear his kid do that.
Yeah. And by the way, it's a good thing he died when he did. Because we know how movie collectors are insane.
Wow,
and if it would have been closer to this time, I think people would have actually dug it up. Talk about macabre.
Yeah,
would have dug it up to get the cape because that's like one of the crown jewels apparently in prop. In the prop world,
is
if they could find one of the capes he used from the actual movie. So
Bob Marley shows up on our list, and certainly famous for a number of things. Certainly playing a great guitar player, underrated guitar player, Bob Marley. Underrated songwriter and guitar
just
player,
artist
really.
In general, yeah.
So not too surprising, Bob was buried with one of his loves, his Red Gibson Les Paul guitar.
Oh.
And weed. Because, yes, this was the other thing that Bob Marley was known for.
Bob really liked to smoke a little, you know.
Just in case. A little bit. Just in case he can't find a hookup in heaven. Or, you know, he can't even actually do that.
I love that idea. but, I mean, come on, that's, boy, and that's with his guitar. I mean.
That's really cool. You're
that
focusing
is a cool
on the guitar,
thing. And it's such
cool.
a the kind of guitar. I mean, of course, Les Paul. I mean, you know, the great guitar, the solid body guitar is Les Paul from Wisconsin, invented the solid body electric guitar. And it has become a standard in like any genre of music you want to talk about. That is the electric guitar.
Andy Warhol was buried with his Interview magazines and a bottle of Estee Lauder perfume. And I don't know why that makes sense, but it does.
It does for Andy. I tell you what, he was the most, and I'm meaning this not in necessarily a bad way. He was one of the most calculated artists of all time. He did everything for a reason. He liked to, you know, to shock people and surprise them with all of this stuff and say crazy things and that kind of thing. Does not surprise me in the least. This is totally something. Yeah. He's like, and he did it very specifically. He's like, this is I'm going to be. I'm going to be buried with these things.
and I have no doubt with that, piggybacking on what you're saying, that he knew people would talk about like these things.
100%. That was important to him, man. Mm. You got to be talked about.
It's interesting. It's hard to tell within Andy Warhol how much the ego he really did have and how much he knew that acting that way people would talk about, and he loved to get people to talk about
100%.
His art and how much of his life, including every literal aspect of his life. I can't stress enough what Seth is saying. His haircut, his interviews, every word he said was thought about. And so how much did we actually see the real Andy Warhol?
Yeah.
How much of it was just this character he created?
Right. I'm glad you said it like that, because I think in the end, he was his greatest work of art. Not the prints that he made, all these things. And I'm not saying he was a bad artist, not at all. He was a very iconic artist and very good. And the bold, the choices that he did, you know, I'm going to do a soup can. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do it 100 different ways, you know, that kind of thing. But I think by far his greatest creation was Andy Warhol.
His my favorite painting of his is Gun. It's just titled Gun. It's an incredible painting, but it's such a great note, and it's something I've known him my whole life, it feels like, and I've never thought about that, man. That's such a great note. His greatest work of art was him.
Yep.
Like, that's really cool. That's a really good note. Ronnie Van Zant from Lynyrd Skynyrd, his favorite fishing pole and his go-to Texas Hatter's hat. That's awesome.
His fishing pole.
Fishing pole.
I love it. That's totally where his priorities were, you know?
Yeah. With somebody who, it was so sudden.
Yes.
And so tragic and everything. I can't imagine the family had a lot of prep or understanding of what to do if that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it was grabbing things that, you know, he didn't have a long life either. So,
no, he didn't.
You know, didn't have a chance to really have certain items and everything.
But at the same way, you know, I think he had a very marvelous sense of humor, which comes across in a lot of Lynyrd Skynyrd songs that he wrote from the time, you know, Give Me Three Steps, That Smell, those kinds of things. He had a lot of humor in his songs. And I think that's very fitting for him to have. Here's my old fishing pole.
Really would have loved to see, because I feel like they, you know, every band does this. Skynyrd would have come back together, but they also would have probably done solo stuff. And I would have
100%.
Loved to see him work with other artists.
That would have been really interesting, yeah.
Elizabeth Taylor, her last love letters from ex-husband Richard Burton. They divorced for a second time in 76, but he wrote it 3 days before he died in 1984.
Oh, wow.
If you are her other 10 husbands, how do you feel about that? No.
They had that. Theirs was such an interesting relationship, because it was on again, off again. Like you said, they were married twice. They got divorced twice. But it was one of those things where it's obvious that they couldn't stay away from each other.
Yeah.
And the fact that when she passed, that is what she had. I mean, she was in love with him. She was totally in love with him her entire time they knew each other. So.
almost as obvious as what a legend of an actor she was.
Yes. Both of them, for that matter.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I feel like it's a shame with Elizabeth Taylor that younger generations think of her with, you know, her the white diamonds, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And those kind, or her divorces or some of that. Mm-hmm. This was Cleopatra. this was one of the
tremendous actor.
Yeah.
One of the best of all time. She was a child star. And then she became an adult, has so many iconic roles. She was just a tremendous talent. And you're so right. It gets so lost in the shuffle with her celebrity, which was a fodder for a lot of ink was spilled for her life. For I'm not sure why. I really don't know why.
For the acting community, her acting still stands out. She's still one of the greats.
Yes. Real quick. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah.
With them together. Mm. It's you cannot the acting on it. It's one of the few movies where for most of it, I'm genuinely uncomfortable.
Yes.
It makes you feel so uncomfortable watching these two go at it. And that's how good the actors were. I mean, you have to be in that level to do it.
The backstory, the story behind the scenes of that movie is just as incredible as the movie itself. Frank Sinatra, a flask of Jack Daniels.
To the surprise of absolutely nobody.
Right. Like, I would have been more surprised if he wasn't buried with it.
No. Right.
Tony Curtis is a little more surprising to the great Tony Curtis. Mm-hmm. His iPhone, a Stetson hat, driving gloves, seven Splenda packets, and a Perricoat tablet. I don't even know what to do with that. I have no idea what to do with that.
Again, was there anyone more flamboyant than Tony Curtis in his real life? I mean, he was just, again, he was a tweaker. He loved to tweak people. I mean.
So that's what makes me wonder. Did he do this just to mess with us?
I think he did. I totally think he did, man.
If a 17, you know, not to be macabre here, but if a young person was buried with those things, I'd be a little surprised, let alone an older man like Tony Curtis.
He was quite old when he passed away, so yeah.
And you know, again, one of these actors that I think it's lost in the shuffle a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that necessarily he's even as popular as like somebody that, you know, when they do talk about him, they don't talk about his talent. They talk about the ascot or something like that.
Some of the stuff he did. Yeah.
I don't think it's far-fetched to say that his daughter is more famous than he was ever, really, in some ways, and Jamie Lee. And certainly has gotten so much. One of the things that can be thankful about having a long career is, yes, you have these dips in work, mm-hmm. but then you get the coveted comeback story that very few actors get.
Mm-hmm.
It's so few that do.
Right.
I've heard some people talk about, well, that's not a true comeback story. That's not a true comeback story. This isn't a true comeback story. No, all of them are.
Yes.
All of them are. I mean, especially to people that don't understand how hard it is to make it in this industry.
Yes.
And there are literally thousands of people standing behind you waiting to take your job. And as soon as you muck up, they're right there.
Yeah.
And the audience forgets about you within 5 seconds. So to have a comeback like Jamie Lee did, let alone having an already established career, Tony Curtis, I don't know that his legacy stands where that one is.
Right. Yeah. He was in some iconic movies, you know, of course, Some Like It Hot, probably his most, ironically, his most famous role when he dresses up as a woman.
True.
Because when you get someone, when you're up against with someone like Jack Lemmon, everyone, you know, great in that one, but you could point out, oh, and in The Apartment. Wow, he was great in that. The Days of Wine and Roses, The Odd Couple, you know, all these other things.
Oh, The Days of Wine and Roses.
That's a fabulous movie. But Tony Curtis is like, what else was he in again? You know, the kind of thing. We know who he was, but yeah.
Icon, you know, in some way for his generation.
Absolutely, though.
Let's see here. And then a Ronald Dahl, his prized snooker cues, his favorite HB pencils, some assorted chocolates, and a circular power saw.
He had to be messing with us.
If you get buried alive, it seems great to have a power saw. But keep in mind I said power saw. Yeah.
Like, give me a good old, if that's what I was worried about, give me like a cross cut or something, right? Yeah.
I feel like give me a
hacksaw. I don't know.
I love the idea of him like doing all this in case he's buried alive. And he gets buried alive. And he's like, whew, see, they laughed at me when I said bury me with a power saw.
Oh, shoot.
Who's laughing? No. Oh,
Well, you know what? That, you know, sometimes you just got to laugh at yourself.
Oh, beans.
You know, oh, here I am. Oh, well.
But again, it makes sense. The chocolate, of course, you know, Willy Wonka and all that stuff. But oh my gosh, that he. By the way, you want to hear an absolutely fascinating life story?
Mm-hmm.
Raoul Dahl, spy, during World War II, and some of the other stuff he did. I mean, wow, he had an amazing life.
There's a couple of writers from that era. Ian Fleming.
Another one.
Their backstories are just as interesting as the characters they created.
Exactly. Wow.
Leonard Bernstein had a copy of Alice in Wonderland, a baton, and a copy of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 5, which he conducted at Robert F. Kennedy's funeral.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
I didn't know that. Oh, my gosh.
It's pretty interesting.
The only thing I can think of.
I knew that either.
What would Mahler have thought if he knew someone was. Because for those of you who don't know, Gustav Mahler was a composer of some tremendous symphonies. He was from Eastern Europe. He eventually immigrated to the United States for a while. He was also a Kapellmeister, which means he was he led operas and stuff like that. He wasn't just a composer. He was a conductor and all these other things. Who really had a lot, so much self-doubt about his own work. He was very disparaging of his own stuff. He had a real hard time with his own self-esteem, surprisingly enough. The idea that someone as important as Leonard Bernstein in conducting in the United States, that was what he was buried with, is just, that's really remarkable. And I'm guessing it has something to do with the JFK connection and all that, I'm sure, for him, for Bernstein. Yeah. But still, that idea is really cool. And I didn't know that.
Interesting to be able to talk about Leonard Bernstein too. Another guy that we don't get to talk about nearly enough.
Boy, another artist. I mean, people know him as a composer for West Side Story and that kind of stuff. I guess again, a fabulous conductor. He was also a writer. He wrote several articles and books. He narrated some stuff. He had a really cool voice. I mean, again, just a complete creative person.
Huge activist. Huge activist.
That's true, too.
Whether it's civil rights, Vietnam War. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that he did in that regard. Oftentimes,
and somehow got away with it. I don't know how he did that.
I was just going to say, like, where other artists would be hesitant to do a lot of the things he did them and kept going, kept working. Like,
I'm telling you.
Very shocking.
That's really cool, though.
You don't see that happen at all.
No.
And we wrap up with my Nana's favorite actor of all time, Humphrey Bogart. Bogey. Oh,
love me some Bogey.
He's looking at you, kid. A golden whistle charm that he gave to wife Lauren Bacall as a nod to their movie To Have or To Have Not.
The movie, that's where they met. That's the movie they met. Wow.
Bogey was not one of these guys that had demands. It was one of these guys that needed even a trailer. Showed up and did his job.
Yep.
Had his lines memorized. The moment he showed up on set, just a constant pro of things. It makes such sense that he would have not, like, you know, I want to be buried with this and this and this and this or whatever. But you know that he would have something. I would be shocked if he didn't show up on this list because he was a sentimentalist. He was somebody that, you know.
Which is so surprising, not only because of the characters he played, you know, tough guys for the most part. And he was kind of like that in real life, too.
Yeah.
You said, he was, when he was working, he was the absolute pro. When he wasn't, he would, like, sit at a bar and shout insults at people because I'm guessing he didn't even know what to do with himself, kind of thing.
I think so. Yeah.
But
similar to John Wayne, I think.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But when he met, he and Bacall met. I mean, it was love. And you could tell, even though he was a lot older than she was, you know, he was like in his 40s. She was 19 when they did To Have and Have Not, which, by the way, awesome movie. You need to watch it. It's super cool. But they had such a connection to each other. And even after all those years, you know, after she lived so much longer after he had passed away, even then you could tell. You know, it was for her. She missed him like every day. It was one of those. They had one of those rare, like, eternal love stories, which was so cool.
Most people grew up liking Casablanca
of course.
And To Have It Have Not of those. Me and my Nana, we love Key Largo. That was our movie.
Fabulous movie.
It's a perfect cast. There are few movies that have a more perfect cast than Key Largo does. Mm-hmm. You have some of the greatest actors of all time in that movie, doing bit parts even, you know, in smaller roles. It still holds up to this day. I think that one stands out.
Edward G. Robinson is so good in that.
He steals the show.
He steals the show from
Bacall and Bogey and these actors and everything. But one thing that always stood out to me about that movie, I guess I don't remember it from To Have or Have Not or anything, but I remember seeing those two, and even as a little kid, those two love each other. Mm-hmm. Like, those two.
You could tell.
Yeah.
When they were together on screen.
Even as a little kid, you could see it.
Yeah.
Like, it's a love story for the ages.
Yeah.
And two of the greats.
And it's funny how their chemistry actually translated on screen. That doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
With people who really, you know, really dig each other and have a relationship and all this kind of stuff. But on the screen, flat, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But they had it. They had it, and it came across in spades.
I can't think of, as we're wrapping up here, I can't think of necessarily any celebrity item I would want to be or anything like that. But just trying to, you know, think of something for the show. I think Mork suspenders from Mork and Mindy.
Oh, my God.
I think that'd be fun. I think that would be, you know, I'm trying to think of something that would make my loved ones smile a little bit. So that's my first thought. That's just off the top of my head. That's right. Yes.
Because you're talking about your feet, you know, your clown feet. Yeah, you wear some clown shoes.
You can't shut the door. You can't close the casket.
These darn shoes.
I don't know. I don't know.
That's a fun thing to think of. Or we can think about, you know, actors that are alive today. What would they be buried with? So my question, like, does Michael Keaton get buried with the cowl?
You know? Yeah.
Probably not. I'm guessing most of them are like, no, or I'm not doing that. But I love the idea of, you know, from an iconic role or something like that.
What would you bury this person with?
Yeah. Just don't bug them with it because they're like, I don't want to talk about my death. You know?
And how so many actors used to hate being typecast or being like associated with this one particular thing or whatever, where some just embrace it. Yeah.
For some reason, it always comes back to Boris Karloff in the show. I don't know why, but he said one of the most remarkable things. He said he loved being typecast because a typecast actor is a working actor.
Yeah.
He never, after he made Frankenstein, again, a nice Halloween tie-in here. Mm-hmm. After he made Frankenstein, he never had to worry about work again. He was always in demand. He was always, that next job was always there. And as someone who took a long time to get his break, he was in his 40s when Frankenstein came along. And he got his break. And like James talks about a lot, you know, it seems like the people who are a little older when they get their break are the ones that work the most, you know, because I think they're the ones that appreciate it so much. Boy, did he appreciate the idea of being typecast. He had no problem with it.
Keep that in mind, all you casting directors out there. Seth and I are certainly, you know, we're at that age where we'll appreciate it. We'll appreciate it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And we appreciate all of you. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody.
Yep.
Coming up, we're going to do a special thing here to kind of bring you home our anniversary episode.
Because it's been 2 years now since we did our first episode, and that one, James and I talked about, we didn't want to do the normal, you know, top five scary movies for Halloween. We wanted to talk about some movies that we thought were cool, not necessarily horror movies, but really tied in with the season, suspenseful, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we think when we come back, we think you will enjoy this little flashback to the first episode of Director's Cut when we come back on WFHR. Welcome back to the Director's Cut, everybody. I am Seth. I'm joined by James, of course.
Hey, hey.
And one of the other things we want to do with the show is we want to talk, of course, movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to a little bit later in the show. We'll get to you giving us some movies to go through
because
we'd love to get your suggestions on movies that maybe we've never heard before or anything like that to take a look at. We'd love to do that. But right now, Halloween is tomorrow.
Yeah.
Which means that horror movies are
this
on everybody's mind.
This is Halloween.
Jack Skellington has made an appearance. He always does here at this time of year. So I'm going to go to James first and is there any Halloween movie or not even a Halloween movie, just like maybe a tense movie, like a little scary movie, a movie that you find that kind of gives you the chills?
I grew up on the Hitchcock style of horror telling and suspense and everything. So those have always been my favorite type of movies. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you asked this, Seth, because I could easily take this opportunity to ramble about A Nightmare Before Christmas, which I love and I encourage people to watch.
Good Halloween movie.
But if you're looking for a newer film and a one that fits the season and everything, I cannot recommend enough, and I never do recommend, but I cannot recommend enough the movie Nope. The new Jordan Peele movie.
Oh, yes. I have not seen it. I've heard of it.
It is suspense and touch of horror, but not really. It's not your blood and gore horror. It's more, oh, what's going on behind the door? What's going on up there? That kind of thing. The actors do an incredible job of showing this on their face, of giving you so much of this to where you don't even need the special effects, you know? It is an incredible cast. Jordan Peele is the new king of suspense. He has taken the mantle and run with it. He is one of those sought after people in the game right now. And he's really good at this. He's shown it multiple times with Us and with Get Out, with his work with the Twilight Zone TV show. His production company, like Monkey Paw, bringing that back because he loves that type of storytelling so much.
His production company is called Monkey Paw, which is a classic horror story. I mean, come on.
So good.
He knows
what he's doing. Like, I always thought he was just incredible at comedy. Keen Peele was awesome. I dare say he found his real niche.
Yeah, that's
saying something because he's very good at comedy.
He's very good at all. Yes, indeed.
I was a little disappointed when Get Out came out and like, oh, he's getting behind the camera. I was looking forward to seeing him act more and everything. Not anymore. No, I would love to see him act still, sure.
Right.
But man, do I love his directing. And I just have a hard time believing if you're looking for suspense, if you're looking for horror, and you're looking for something new, then Nope wouldn't hit it on every cylinder. Like,
that's
it's a great cast, great show. It's really the I didn't think about it beforehand, but as soon as you brought up the question, I'm like, oh, here's a good one.
That's a good one. Yes.
How about you?
Exactly. So for me, I actually have two. See, I'm already breaking the rules. I have two because I've got a classic one, and then I've got a one that's not really a horror film, but it's very much a suspenseful film. The first one I was going to go is the classic 1963, The Haunting.
Directed
by Robert Wise. It's considered one of the scariest movies or creepiest movie. I don't know how you could say it, but it's a scary movie that doesn't show you anything.
Nope.
It's all suspense. It's all tension. And it is like your piano wire tension we're talking about on this thing.
I started to tighten up my hand as soon as you said it, Seth. I've seen that movie since I was a kid.
Yes.
And yeah, that's one of those ones.
It is. If you have not had the chance to see it, and I would recommend, don't do the remakes.
No.
They're not as good as the original. It's in black and white. And it's got some of the most atmosphere you are ever going to find. I saw an interview with Robert Wise, and he said that people went before he passed. That, of course, he had an interview before he passed. He can't do it afterwards. Jeez. Anyway. he said that people, that was the thing. You know, here's a man who directed, I mean, he directed West Side Story.
Right,
he directed
right.
some big films. He yeah. said people would come up to him and say not only that The Haunting was their favorite film that he'd ever done, it was also the scariest thing they had ever seen.
Wow.
And considering what has come since, you know, all the gory horror and all this stuff, it's a remarkable achievement, I have to say that.
I almost, especially if you haven't in a long time or you've never watched classic, like older movies and everything, and all you've seen is the modern storytelling of horror and suspense and everything, I really recommend to that person to watch those. I think you will be blown away by how intense you find it.
Yes, it's amazing.
I really think, too, as 80s kids and stuff, growing up in the time where, hey, we can do splatters, we can do this and everything.
Friday the 13th,
Nightmare
and all
that
on Elm Street,
stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
We got a little numb to that kind of thing.
We did.
And it brought me back to the style of storytelling with the Jordan Peele stuff and with more of that, because it seems like that's... For like nowadays, there's a billion types of movies, and everybody can put these movies out there now.
Yep.
The majority of the more budgeted stuff is going more suspense.
Yep.
And it's almost like the people with not as much budget are going more gore and special effects.
Right.
Which is
interesting.
Like that.
Yeah.
It is interesting, and I kind of like how that's worked.
Yeah.
I think you'll get a real kick out of some of these movies.
Yes.
It's a real good idea. All great suggestions.
Yep. The next one I want to put out there, and this one is more for people who have children, because it deals with, I think, a fear most parents have about losing your child and or not knowing where your child is. It's I can't remember the exact year off the top of my head. It's in the late 60s. Bunny Lake is Missing, which was directed by Otto Preminger, who is one of the most underrated directors of all time. He directed some amazing films.
Man, that's
and
a deep
we could
cut.
Do it. We could do a whole director's cut episode of just Otto Preminger movies because he was amazing. But I digress. but the movie is the premise is a woman and her daughter, you know, they're in a like a isolated area. And I think it's in England, if I remember correctly. I haven't seen it in a while. But But she leaves her daughter alone for a minute. Mm. She comes back. Her daughter's gone. And her name is Bunny Lake. Oh. And the rest of the film is her frantically trying to find what happened to her daughter. Yeah. It's I mean, as a parent, it's terrifying because it's like, oh, my gosh, you know, you could totally see this happening to you. Yeah. And it's very paranoid as well because it's like something happened. No one's talking about it.
Yeah.
And there's something behind all of this. It has some really great performances. The most like out of left field casting I've ever seen in my life. Noel Coward is cast as one of this really creepy guy that's in the movie. And, you know, this is Noel Coward.
Yeah.
You know, the light, the airy, you know, guy who wrote musicals for a living and songs. Hmm. And he plays a very dark character, which is really brilliant. I mean, brilliant casting in that.
Check that out.
But it's
Seen it in a long time.
Yeah, it is. It's a brilliant movie. It's one of those, not a lot of people have seen it. But it's for atmosphere, for things like that. Check it out. It's really suspenseful.
Just real quickly, an honorable mention. My mom, who loves horror, loves Stephen King, biggest Stephen King fan I've ever known and ever will know. Book-wise, no Stephen King story ever scared her, ever kept her laid up at night, except for Pet Sematary. Pet Sematary freaked her out. And I think in part because of what you're touching on there about the child aspect of it and everything. It was after I was born. And she literally like was up for a couple of nights from that book.
Wow.
And no other book has ever done that to her, no other like story or anything like that. So if you're looking for a good book, maybe that's one.
That's a good Halloween book. Yeah, well, you know, you could say that about a lot of Stephen King books. Yeah. Of course. Right. Just find out whatever you're scared of. And he's written a book about it.
Right.
Because he's that prolific as well.
Good stuff.
So yeah, those are some recommendations for some fun, spooky Halloween movies. Not necessarily themed in Halloween, but they will make your hair stand on end. So we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Director's Cut, everyone. Hope you're having a great Sunday evening. James and I are enjoying our alone time, I guess you could call it. We don't have any guests this week, but we're really enjoying what we're doing. And our next segment is something we're going to try here. Correcting myth takes. In other words, we're going to look at different urban legends, myths, mysteries in entertainment history, and there's a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to see if we can't see what's true and what's not true and what we can really find out about it. And I came up with this idea because I was looking through music stuff, which is what I do all the time, and I came across a singer by the name of Johnny Ace.
Mm.
Johnny Ace had one big hit, basically, in 1955, an R&B hit called Pledging My Love. And we'll play a little snippet here for you so you can get that music in your head while we're talking about what happened.
Forever, my darling, my love will be true. Always and forever, I'll love just you. Just promise me, darling, your love in return. Make this fire in my soul, dear, forever burn.
So this song became a hit posthumously.
Yeah,
Johnny Ace died before it became a hit. In fact, the reason it was one of the first, he died. Let's push his record.
Oh, wow.
Because now everyone will hear it thing, which it happens all the time now. Mm-hmm. A famous singer dies and then their catalog blows up on Amazon or whatever. People start listening to buying their music and that kind of thing. It's been happening for a long time, in other words.
Yeah.
But Johnny Ace was an interesting one because the myth surrounding his death is that he was backstage at a show. And he was playing Russian roulette. Yes, Russian roulette, for those who don't know, is when you put a single bullet into a revolver, spin the revolver, that's not the chamber, it's the, I can't even remember what it's called. Anyway, you spin the thing, and then you see, and you point it at your head to see if the bullet's there. Extremely dangerous. Don't anyone ever do that.
Dumbest game in history.
In history. Yeah. I don't know what it's supposed to prove. Anyway, so Johnny was doing this. Makes the mistake and he blows his own brains out.
Ugh.
That is what the story was. The myth was he was playing Russian roulette. Well, a few years later, and we'll get to the reason why we're even talking about this, because it seemed to have an effect on a lot of people, especially a lot of artists that would come later.
Huh.
And we'll get to that in a little bit, but it seems like the story is not quite right. So it's true. He did shoot himself and it was accidental. He did not mean to commit suicide. And everyone knew that from the beginning. It was an accidental death. He was 25 years old at the time. Hmm. So talking to people later about this, they did talk to his bassist. Let's see. His bassist, Curtis Tillman, was his name.
Hmm.
He witnessed the event, said, "I will tell you exactly what happened. Johnny Ace had been drinking, and he had this little pistol he was waving around the table, and someone said, 'Be careful with that thing.' And he said, 'It's okay. Gun's not loaded. See?' And he pointed it at himself with a smile on his face, and bang."
Wow.
Sad, sad thing. Big Mama ran out of the dressing room yelling, "Johnny Ace just killed himself." The Big Mama he's referring to is a classic R&B singer by the name of Big Mama Thornton. Like 300 pounds, and she had nasty attitude. She was great. I love Big Mama Thornton. Yeah. Her first song was "They Call Me Big Mama Because I Weigh 300 Pounds." That was the first song she ever recorded.
Yeah.
She also recorded the very first version of Hound Dog.
That's right.
Written by
I knew the name sounded familiar.
Yeah, that's right. Written by Lieber and Stoller, and later, of course, Elvis made it a gigantic hit. By the way. Listen to the first version. It's nothing like the Elvis version. He cut so much of it out.
Wow.
It's a very different song. Huh. But go check it out. But anyway, Big Mama was on the bill. She was part of this tour. And in her written statement about what happened, that was that Ace had been playing with a gun, but not playing Russian roulette. According to Thornton, Ace pointed the gun at his girlfriend and another woman who were sitting nearby, but did not fire. He then pointed the gun toward himself, bragging that he knew which chamber was loaded. The gun went off, shooting him in the side of the head. According to his biographer, Nick Toshis, Ace shot himself with a .32 pistol, not a .22, which is what everyone assumed that it was. And it happened a little more than an hour after he bought a new 1955 Oldsmobile. Never got to use his car. Too bad, man. Johnny. It's a pointless death, really, for someone who was on the way up in the music industry. So because of this, it's really amazing what happened because of that. People took notice, and there were a whole bunch of tribute songs that came after this about Johnny Ace. And he wasn't, like I said, he was just beginning to be really popular throughout the country. But he had, some of the songs that were performed. Let's see if I can find the list here. Johnny Has Gone. There was also a song called Johnny Ace's Last Letter, Salute to Johnny Ace, Why Johnny Why, and Johnny's Still Singing.
Wow.
Right after he died, all these songs came out, tributes to him specifically. Now, later on, one of his other songs, Never Let Me Go, was performed by Bob Dylan and Joan Baez on their Rolling Thunder Review in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Elvis Presley recorded Pledging My Love on his final album, that same song. Paul Simon wrote and performed the song The Late Great Johnny Ace, from 1983, in which a boy, upon hearing about the death of Ace, orders a photograph of the deceased singer, which is a cool story.
Yeah.
And but again, it's one of these things that for a guy that wasn't that famous, it was an amazing outpouring of this grief of the singer. And as you heard in that little clip of the thing, he had a good voice, R&B voice, very soulful singer and everything. It's also been used, that song, Pledging My Love, has been used in Mean Streets.
Oh.
Martin Scorsese used it. The film Christine, directed by John Carpenter. The film Back to the Future by Robert Zemeckis. And the 1992 film Bad Lieutenant, of all films. Abel Ferrara directed that one.
One of these things is not like the other, but
Harvey Keitel's in two of those, actually. I just realized that. Bad Lieutenant and Mean Streets.
Yeah.
So, but that kind of puts that one to bed a little bit. He did accidentally shoot himself, but it wasn't Russian roulette. He was still being extremely irresponsible with a gun.
Wow.
I just want to put that out there. Please, everybody. Don't mess around with guns like that.
No, that is a good thing to note. Yes. That is an awesome story, Seth. That is so cool. I didn't know any of that.
That one myth take. Now, you have something for us here.
Well, yeah, because I kind of taken this in a little bit on the other end of this, where these are stories a little more that maybe you didn't know about going on behind the scenes. The movie Total Recall, the original Total Recall, I'm speaking of, with Arnold Schwarzenegger and everything. One of those movies where a lot of good actors in it, but performances that you may not like, you came to expect certain things from them, and you didn't really see it in that one. A good example is Michael Ironside. Michael Ironside, incredibly good actor.
Oh, very good actor.
Especially in the 80s, one of the bigger names of the 80s, even though he may not have been a household name.
Yeah.
You saw him in a million things.
Villain.
Yeah, always great the villain. Always a great villain, yep. including in Total Recall.
Yep.
But was not, during the filming process, just seemed to not be there. Hmm. And a young actor like Arnold Schwarzenegger happened to notice this. Now, Arnold is kind of, especially at this point in the game, you know, he's been a politician. He's been in the public eye since he was a kid.
Yeah.
And I still don't think people really know him, though. Like, with all that being said.
He's been very guarded. He's a very private man in the end. Yeah. He is.
One thing that I think that you wouldn't know unless you just did a little bit of digging, very well liked. Like, mm-hmm. there is not a person who has worked with Arnold that has anything bad to say about him.
Yeah.
He is very, like, giving on set. Mm-hmm. He does his job. He learns his lines. Not like your typical guy coming from the weightlifting industry or sports in general.
In general, right.
He came into this, like, I want to learn. I want to be good at this, going back to Conan and working with James Earl Jones on a one-on-one basis just to try to get, like, the voices down. And that's pretty cool, you know, on James Earl's part of taking the time to do it. And Arnold to... He didn't have to do that. Nobody was expecting him to be a thespian, but he wanted to be.
He wanted to
be
learn
better
yeah.
at it. So he's doing this Total Recall movie, and he's paying attention. He's a people watcher, and he's noticing that after every scene that Michael Ironside gets done, he runs off and is on the phone. And this is back in the day where you're on, you know, landlines and everything.
Yeah.
So Michael Ironside was consistently on the phone between takes. When he botched the subject with, when Arnold broached the subject with Ironside, he was told that he was phoning his sister and that she was currently suffering from cancer.
Oh, wow.
Arnold immediately brought Michael to his trailer, and they had a three-hour conversation between the three of them, where Arnold took the time to talk to his sister about exercises that she could do and different foods she could eat to really help, you know, give her energy and help her keep going, and just really basically lifted her spirits, really something that nobody was able to really do for this young lady. Mm-hmm. Arnold was able to do, and he took the time out of it to do this, and Michael Ironside goes out of his way to tell people about this. Because you guys don't realize what a good man this guy is.
Yeah.
Like, and they're still friends to this day because of that whole little thing there. Another interesting...
That's a nice little story. That's great.
One other one I think is noteworthy, too, and it's a little kind of piggybacking off of that. Most of us, especially us 80s kids, I say, name me a famous quotable movie. You're going to go to The Princess Bride. It's been watched so many times. It's one of those generational movies where even the next generation loves it.
Marvelous script. The lines in it are marvelous, yes.
And one of the first movies that me as a young little kid running around the house wanting to be an actor quoted. It was one of the first movies I would quote, including, obviously, my name is Indigo Montoya. You killed my father, prepare to die.
Right.
I would drive my nan and papa and my dad crazy with that. My dad did not like me saying this line to him.
You killed my father.
He'd get very offended by this line, but I didn't slow me down.
Of course not.
I would push it sometimes with my dad where I would say, I want my father back, you blank blank. And I would say the actual line as in like 8-9 year old kid to my dad. And he would laugh and then he'd be like, Jimmy, don't let your mother hear you say that, like that kind of thing. But as an adult and even as a teenager and as I would grow older and stuff, and I dissect so much of that movie, and in particular, Mandy Patinkin, who is one of my favorite actors of all time.
I love him. I love Mandy Patinkin.
Top 10, top 15 favorite actors of all time. And I'll admit, a little biased because he's a Chicagoan.
I knew it.
You know, you don't have
That's
to.
Fine.
Even,
fine.
You didn't even need me to tell you
John
that.
John Cusack. Yeah, we right, know. We you know.
But his performance in particular, and for the life of me, I couldn't understand why he would drop his accent when he delivered that line, I want my father back. And there's been a lot of history behind, like, oh, he just, you know, he lost his focus in that scene.
Yeah.
He wasn't, he didn't care. A lot of different things have been said over the years about this performance. Well, during the filming of The Princess Bride, Mandy Patinkin, who of course plays Indigo, his father died from cancer.
Mm.
And Mandy, being the professional he was, the show must go on.
Yep.
I've got to keep working. They were nice enough. Robert Zemeckis directed.
Rob Reiner,
who directed it.
Yep.
It's like, no, take time off. Go see go to the funeral and all that. Mm-hmm. So they paused filming.
Wow.
All of it. I think they did do some stage shots and stuff, but they.
I'm sure they did something. Yeah.
But when he came back from the funeral, they had to shoot the scene where he kills the six-fingered man.
Right.
And he gives him that special fire, that line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when that six-fingered man finally realizes that his goose is cooked and all that, and he says, I'll give you anything, money, this, this.
Yep.
What do you want? I want my father back. back you.
Yep.
And he drops the accent because he ain't acting in that scene.
No,
people.
No.
That's not, like, we've seen Mandy Patinkin act, and we know how his caliber is and how great he is. Yep. But in that moment, he's just a guy.
He's wishing, missing his father.
Yeah.
Totally missing his father. Yeah.
And I can't even think about it without it moving me.
Yeah.
Like, it's just such a credit to Rob Reiner for keeping that scene.
Yeah.
It was one take. And they got it.
They got it.
And
it's turned into this like iconic moment of
so
this
huge.
Iconic film. Who doesn't remember the passion? I mean, you can see it in his face.
It's so crazy to think that a movie that is so quoted, so well loved,
yeah.
and that may be the scene that sticks yeah. with people so much because
right.
it's so real.
Yeah.
It's so. And to Mandy's credit, he wanted to refilm the scene. He's like, I'm sorry. I dropped the accent. Oh, God, I dropped the accent. He was horrified.
Yeah.
Rob Reiner, the whole cast, they voted on this, and they kept it in.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
You know, I've seen a documentary where they kind of went back, all the actors, and looked at the thing. And I didn't realize at the time because I didn't know. And they didn't talk about it in the documentary. But Mandy Patinkin got, when he was talking, he got very emotional
yeah.
about the movie. Mm. And now I understand why. Because it makes him think of his father. And then that makes so much sense. And it wasn't just that because
it was
a special thing to be a part of. You can tell if you ask any of the actors, they were like, no, this was special. This
yeah.
was something that
yes.
you knew that you were on a good movie. You knew that you were on one of these special projects. So
it just doesn't, you know, you don't get to have those moments very often with how much money, how much time is put into these things. And
oh my gosh,
some of those scenes that we see.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep going here because yep. we're yeah. running out of time. But there's other scenes that I'm thinking of right away that, you know, mm-hmm. that are in our lexicon because the director decided to keep it in, even though another director would say, no, I want another cut.
No, this is not good. This isn't right. Yeah, yeah. But there was something about it that they saw and they were like, ah, let's go with that. Real quick, since we do have a couple minutes left, Arnold Schwarzenegger story. My mom got her master's degree from the University of Wisconsin Superior. Which,
right
for those of you who know Arnold Schwarzenegger, he attended that school
right,
for a
right.
while. And the year my mom graduated, she wanted to walk. And it's like, oh, that's cool. We find out just a couple months before the thing, oh, they're giving an honorary degree to Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he's coming.
Whoa.
To the commencement.
Whoa.
And he's going to give a speech. And we were like, yeah. Okay. So, like, well, we get to go because my mom's graduated. They had to, you know, they had to limit the number of people because he was this thing. And, We get in there, we're ready, you know, they're starting to do things, and he's late. You know,
yeah,
he's
yeah,
a star,
yeah.
come on,
yeah.
you know. But he walks in, and he's shaking people's hands and stuff. By the way, I thought he was taller than that.
Yeah, right.
He's shorter than I thought he was. But he came up, you know, and he did his speech. It was very funny. He did a great speech, you know, a lot of humor in it. But he talked about, you know, when his time at UWS and all these things. And my mom was like, well, I'm going to get a picture here. You know, why not? So because he sat with everybody when everyone came up and got their diplomas. He was in the front. He didn't go anywhere.
Wow.
He stayed.
Wow.
And my mom got a picture or two with him and got a picture of him, a real close up. And it was really cool. But because he had his, you know, the gown on and everything,
yeah.
the mortarboard, he was ready to go. So that was really cool.
That's so cool that he
yeah.
stuck around and he stayed.
He did.
Like, that's above and beyond.
Yeah.
That, it was
yeah.
cool of him to show up, let
yeah.
alone to do that. I like that story. That's really cool to hear, man.
Yeah, that's my Arnold Schwarzenegger story.
Love it. What we got here? We're wrapping up, right?
Yeah, I think
okay,
we got to wrap this up here.
And that's going to wrap it for our third session of Director's Cut. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. We mentioned before, we want your recommendations for movies, songs, things you want us to review. That includes these myths.
If you have something, yes, bring it. Get it to us, please.
We'd love that.
Yeah.
And we'd love if you could spread the word about this and Seth Faces the Music and all of our original weekend content.
Mm-hmm.
Spread the word and let's bring some more people to this station, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of WFHR's Director's Cut.